there, and welcome to Pound the Rock, the Scores NBA podcast. I'm Joe Wolfond, and joining me, as always, is my co-host Joseph Cacciaro. Talk to me, Cash.
What's going on, Wolfond? Another eventful week in the NBA and NBA coverage. I know we're going to start off with a bummer. But before we do that, can I just mention one thing that we're not really going to talk about today? And I think it's just worth noting, not because of the milestone itself, which has been covered to death already, but just for a specific stat that I saw floating around that I just think is incredible. So last weekend, since we've last spoken here on Pound the Rock, LeBron James became the first player in history to amass 40,000 career points. Cool milestone, obviously not that big of a deal because he had already become the league's all-time leading scorer, so not huge. But a stat I saw multiple people share, they think they put it on the broadcast too, that I just think is so remarkable, and I wanted to share it here today just to speak to LeBron's consistency. And I'm not sure if you know or saw the stat I'm talking about, but they had it broken down by how quickly he got to each segment of 10,000 points. So he got to 10,000 points in 368 games. He scored his next 10,000 points in 358 games. He scored points 20,001 to 30,000 in 381 games. And then he scored the final 10,000 of his first 40,000 points in 368 games, the exact same number of games it took him to score his first 10,000 points. Again, we don't need to talk more LeBron today or the fact he's, you know, the all-time leading scorer in NBA history, but I just wanted to share that because what basketball fan doesn't want to bask in that kind of glorious consistency? That is just incredible.
Do you think that what basketball fans want is to bask in consistency?
No, bask in its consistent greatness. That is in the consistent greatness that is LeBron.
LeBron's great. Nobody's denying it. Congrats to him on getting to 40,000. That is not going to be the subject of today's episode, but obviously a monumental accomplishment among many in that man's career. I just, as a general note too, before we delve into the specifics of this episode, this is my favorite time of the regular season calendar. Post All-Star, everybody's gotten a bit of a break. Legs are fresher. The trade deadline's in the rear view, and teams are starting to figure themselves out in the wake of making some new additions in a lot of cases. And it's before that little lull in kind of late March, early April, where teams are kind of more focused on resting up for the playoffs. I think this is always just a very fun stretch of regular season basketball where you're getting quality competition night after night. And, you know, last episode we delved into the most confusing teams in the league. And I thought as a counterbalance to that, we ought to talk about some teams that, because they have been so consistently good this year and have been thriving on a sense of stability, we almost don't talk about them enough because in a lot of cases, there's not that much to talk about. They've just been good from pretty much start, not to finish, but up until now. The season's not over yet. And that doesn't mean that like these teams have not had wobbles, looked shaky at times, don't have flaws, obviously, but like they've just been consistently good. And I think in the East, that is Boston, and in the West, it's Minnesota, Denver, and OKC. So I wanted to devote this episode to talking about those four teams, the paragons of stability and consistency in the league this year, and talk about where they're at as we enter this stretch run here. So why don't we start with Minnesota? Because obviously the big news of yesterday was Karl-Anthony Towns being diagnosed with a meniscus tear. We pretty quickly got news that he will undergo surgery, and that the Wolves expect him to be back early in the playoffs. He's going to be reevaluated in a month. I'm not saying it's not possible that he makes it back for the playoffs. And we can point to the Robert Williams III thing a couple years ago when I think it was 3 weeks after he had the meniscus surgery that he was back on the floor and helping Boston reach the finals. But he also had knee issues throughout that postseason run and then had to have another surgery, a more significant surgery in the offseason, and only played 35 games the following year. So, you know, even in a best case scenario, I don't know that that's the thing that you want to point to as like evidence that this can work out well for the Wolves. I think there is still a good chance that Towns' season is just done, that he's not back for the playoffs, or that if he is, he's going to be significantly limited. And there's no real way to spin this in a way that's positive for the Timberwolves and obviously for Towns himself in what's been, I think, a real season of redemption for him and obviously that whole organization. This just comes at such a terrible time, and I truly feel for the guy. And I mean, last night, obviously one of the more exhilarating regular season wins that you can have in the wake of that injury news. But like looking ahead to the next, what do they have left? 19 games. They're going to run into some challenges on the offensive side of the ball, I think. So where are you at with this Towns injury and with the Wolves on the whole?
I mean, one, as we've obviously noted, it's just a bummer on so many levels. Like, this is an oft-maligned, oft-clowned guy who, you know, was healthy after an injury-ravaged season last year, who was healthy after missing significant time in three of the previous four seasons, who, as I've said many times this season, was really playing the role of perfect secondary star on a legit contender that's number one in the West, doing it all for a franchise that was looking to advance in the playoffs for the first time in 20 years. You know, as you texted me yesterday and then made part of your lead in your write-up on Cat, it's like him and the Timberwolves just can't have nice things. And it's brutal, man. Like, individually for him, team-wise for the Wolves. And I know that it sounds like he should be back at some point in the playoffs, hopefully right for the start of the playoffs. But like, the West is a bloodbath. And there's not a lot of room for error. And so even being the one seed, I mean, that's if they can even hold on to the one seed in this crazy race, that's what, the top four separated by two or three games, the top three are separated by, I think, a half game. Like, if they even survive as a top seed, the matchup would have been brutal regardless of whether they were fully healthy or not. So to take their second leading scorer and take that kind of offensive glue guy away from them, and it's going to make it tough for them to maintain their current position, but obviously it's going to make a first round playoff matchup all the tougher for a team that would have had to, you know, a one seed that would have had a non-traditionally tough first round matchup anyway. So a lot to be concerned about with respect to the Wolves. A lot of pity to go around for Towns. Feel for him and the team. Feel for Wolves fans. It sucks. In terms of my thoughts on kind of where this goes, I think that we're deep enough into the season and the Wolves have established enough of an identity on both ends that I think they should be fine for the most part. And I think if last night was any indication, like, not that I think he's going to be able to average 40 plus a game for the rest of the season, but I do think if there's a star who's kind of up to the task of putting a team on his back, leaving it all like balls to the wall, selling out for every potential win, it's Ant. And him hitting his head on the rim last night on that game-saving block and that just spectacularly scary crash landing back down to the floor afterwards, again, obviously concerning. I'm not saying you want to see guys like risking injury all the time, but I'm sorry, that was friggin' mesmerizing. Like, that was invigorating. And I think we're going to see a lot of that, not necessarily hitting his head on the rim and you know, falling like that, but we're going to see that kind of effort from Ant the rest of the way. And I think that effort from a star that good, from a scorer that good, with a team that should still be able to be the top defense they've been all year, they should be fine, you know? And if Cat can be healthy for the playoffs, they're a contender. I think my biggest concern is, given some of the issues we've seen with Cat in the past in the playoffs, that I thought he was in a good position to overcome this year based on this perfect role he had found. My concern is, does the fact that most likely he's going to be kind of like coming in cold into the playoffs after another extended absence lend itself to him kind of looking like the Cat of old in the playoffs, where maybe he's like not finding the right balance between forcing things and then sometimes disappearing, or, you know, getting himself into foul trouble because he's just not revved up on the defensive end. I don't know, or too revved up. I don't know what it is, but does him coming in cold after a long absence, does it lend itself to him falling victim to those same kind of bad habits in the playoffs?
Are you asking me?
I don't know. I think it does. Would you agree with that? Like,
Not necessarily, but I think it's not going to help. Like, whatever demons that we thought he had an opportunity to exercise in this upcoming playoff run, that's obviously just going to be more challenging coming off an injury and a surgery like this. He's probably going to come back on a minutes restriction. And yeah, how he approaches that, whether like coming into the game in maybe a shortened amount of time nudges him into a place where he is forcing things that much more because he feels like he needs to get himself going or do a little bit more, a little bit too much to try and help his team in that limited time frame. Like, that's, I can see that happening, but I think there's an alternate scenario too where he, because he recognizes that he's not going to be operating at 100%, maybe he is willing to take a little bit more of a backseat and not try to do too much. And I think, you know, I've said this a bunch. I think that a lot of the issues they've run into with him in these spots in the past is like trying to ram a little bit too much through him in the post. Whereas him operating as a guy who's kind of orbiting Edwards, who's picking and popping, who's spotting up, driving closeouts, doing stuff that's a little bit more on the move rather than trying to initiate from a standstill, whether it's in the post or whether it's just like driving into a bunch of bodies from the top of the floor. I think that could wind up being a net benefit, like him recognizing, hey, this is how I can help the offense best, is just by using my gravity to spot up, pull rim protectors away from the rim. And then if I get a closeout, that's when I'm looking to make that next play. But I don't know. It's just, so much is up in the air and so much is going to be determined by how quickly he can make this recovery and what he looks like athletically when he gets back. And I have no way of knowing that right now. And I don't think it's worth it to speculate, but like we said, having this injury now in the rear view is going to make that a little bit more difficult. And that's a huge bummer for him. And it's a huge bummer for the Wolves, who, like, even looking ahead, you mentioned first round matchups, right? I think in that sense, you know, they're not going to fall out of the top four. And I think they have a pretty good chance of staying in the top three. Like, they are right now 3 games clear of the Clippers. And I think they have a chance to hold them off and stay in the top three. But even if they drop to 4, it's like you're looking at the teams 5 through 10. That's a group of 6 teams, essentially, that they could see in the first round in any seed that they wind up securing. Pelicans, Suns, Kings, Mavs, Warriors, Lakers. How much distinction is there really between those 6 teams? Like, there's stylistic stuff where maybe you'd prefer one matchup to another, but because of how bunched up it is, it's not like you're going to be able to control for that anyway. So I actually think in terms of the first round matchups, it doesn't matter all that much where they land 1 through 4. It's looking ahead to the second round and potentially losing home court, potentially having to see Denver in the second round instead of the conference finals. Like, that's where it might hurt them the most. And they've got 3 games left on the slate against Denver in their last 19 here. So it's probably going to be tough for them to hold off the Nuggets, who are 1 game behind them, where like a matchup between those teams, home court, really could have helped the Wolves, obviously. That's the kind of thing where it's like, yeah, this might come back to bite them pretty badly.
Yeah, I'm not so much concerned about the seeding and the first round in terms of like how losing Cat might affect what the matchup is in the first round. For me, it's more so just based on how stacked that second half of the West postseason picture is regardless, and how tough the first round matchup is going to be regardless. Obviously, just worrying about like either A, Cat missing some time in that first round matchup, or just not being up to speed yet, because I don't think they have that wiggle room for error that most teams in their position would when playing a 5-10 seed, just because the West is that tough, obviously. And like, that's where my concern is. Now, listen, like, Ant continuing to go nuclear like he did last night is going to be fun. to watch. He's an absolute dog. I'm sure we'll see more heroics, but I'm curious how the Wolves approach the last quarter of the season now, like lineup wise, schematically. I don't think anything really changes, but like, so they started slow-mo last night, Kyle Anderson, which is what they did last year when Cat missed what, like almost three quarters.
4 months. Yeah. 53 games.
Calf injury, right? So they started Kyle Anderson again last night. We'll see if this is going to be a long-term thing. You know, slow-mo has looked a little slower even this season. I'm not really sure whether that's the right way to go. Some people might say throw Naz Reid in there. You get some of the, obviously not at Cat level, but you get like some of the offensive utility. But
I think it's closer than people might assume in terms of like the skill level between those two guys.
That's what I'm saying. So I see that argument where you say like, hey, throw this guy in there. You get some of the, like, you know, a good chunk of the offensive utility. Definitely don't lose anything defensively other than size. And that kind of fits, but I'm not sure you want to take Reid like off the bench.
No, they're not going to. And the reason is that they don't have any other rotation big men.
Right.
So like, I think they need to keep him in that role. Now, in last night's game, they brought him in pretty early in the, I think like 5 or 6 minutes into the first quarter to pair with Gobert. They didn't close with him, but that's the thing I'm actually really curious to see is how many games does he close
with Gobert?
Because you're thinking about, you know, typically two bigs on the floor is supposed to be something that cramps your spacing, but their spacing is going to be better with Naz out there than with Kyle Anderson. Kyle Anderson's a much better defender, much better playmaker, so you lose those elements, but I think there are probably going to be some situations where it makes sense to close with Naz. And for what it's worth, I haven't checked this today, but going into the game last night, in 640 minutes this season, the Wolves were plus 14 per 100 possessions with Gobert and Naz Reid on the court together, with a 96.2 defensive rating. So those lineups have worked extremely well. Obviously, that's usually coming against mixed groups and not opposing teams' closing lineups. So it's not going to be as effective in those situations. But yeah, if you're looking for somebody to replicate a lot of what Towns does in terms of being a big body, you know, not quite as big. I think Reid is like 6'9 compared to Towns, who's 7 foot, but like a big body who can space, who can put the ball on the floor, who can make plays. That's sort of giving you a lot of the same stuff. And I think, you know, if you want to try to replicate that, I actually think Naz Reid is a terrible rebounder. Like, even if you want to consider him more a wing than a big, he's a bad rebounder. And I think that's the big difference defensively. Like, that's where you might see a drop off from Towns to Reid. Towns has actually been very solid rebounding the ball this year. But that's, you know, if you want to sort of stay big and maintain that identity, then we'll probably see more of that. You know, not starting games necessarily, but closing games.
Yeah. And I'm super curious to see, and it's something you mentioned in the piece you wrote as well, how much we see Nikhil Alexander-Walker, not necessarily starting or finishing, but how much we see him with the other four starters in place of Cat. Obviously, again, a smaller look, but the way I look at it is this. You mentioned in the piece that the Wolves' offense is 10.1 points per 100 possessions worse with Towns off the floor as opposed to when he's on. And this is an offense that overall is very pedestrian. It's 18th. So you figure Cat out for the final quarter of the season, unlikely that they're suddenly going to find their way to a good offense, at least to close the regular season. My thinking is, why not almost go all in on defense if like these are the options being presented to you? And again, you can leave Reid on the bench where he's really thriving. He can still close some games and play with the starters. But like, if you're not going to start Reid, and then the two probably most obvious options are slow-mo or Alexander Walker, I'm leaning Alexander Walker. Like, I just think you lean into your defensive identity. You go all in on that end of the court. Ant will do enough on the offensive end to, like, if the defense is as good at it as it has been, and then you replace Towns with Alexander Walker for whatever it is, 15 to 20 games left, I think they'll be fine. And I'm curious to see.
Okay. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I'm just curious to see whether that's a consideration at all. Like, do we see that at all in these final, whatever it is, 16 games?
So, yeah, I don't think that starting Kyle Anderson is leaning away from their defensive identity. Like, he's still a really, really good defender. And Nikhil is also super long, into the ball, great at the point of attack. They're slightly different in that way. Like, Slomo's a little bit more defending in, like, the lower half of the defense, doing work as a low man, guarding bigger dudes, helping on the back line. Like, he does more of that stuff than Nikhil does, whereas Nikhil's more of, like, the point of attack irritant. And I think if you're looking at the construction of that starting lineup, if you're thinking about it defensively, you kind of already have that point of attack stopping with Jaden McDaniels and Ann Edwards. So I wonder if they just feel like they need more of what Kyle Anderson brings than what Nikhil brings. I think that actually makes sense. Now, you could shift Jaden McDaniels to a role where he's doing like the Kyle Anderson thing on the lower half of the defense. He's very good at doing that. And if you want to have, you know, Ant and Nikhil at the point of attack and move Jaden down, then yeah, that could still work really well. But I'm just sort of gaming it out that way, where I think, you know, defensively, I don't see there being a huge amount of distinction between those two guys with that starting lineup specifically. I think offensively is where Nikhil can maybe open things up for them more than Kyle Anderson would. But again, like, Kyle Anderson's like a really good playmaker, makes good decisions. He can work the two-man game with Gobert. I think there are arguments for it either way, but I'll be interested to see, like, is the slow-mo thing the thing that they stick with, that they're married to, because it is what they did for last year the whole time that Towns was out? Or are we going to see them experiment a little bit more based on feel, based on matchup, whatever? And how they close games is also going to be of real interest for me. But to the point about the defense, that's obviously the selling point with this team. That's their bread and butter. And I think it has a chance to be even better with Towns out. As much as I think, and I've said it before, I think he's one of the most improved defenders in the league this season. Him figuring out how to defend as a four alongside Gobert, both, you know, navigating space, navigating screens, working as a low man, making those rotations and rebounding the ball, that's been huge. But I think they can be better without him. And as it is, Cash, so when I do the like relative offensive and defensive rating, I use the basketball reference ratings, which are slightly different than the ones that NBA.com uses, which themselves are slightly different than like PBP stats. Everybody has some slight variations on the way that they calculate these metrics, but I use Basketball Reference because it's the only site with like readily available relative ratings. So that's just adjusting for league average. So the Wolves this season per Basketball Reference are 7.1 points per 100 possessions better than league average defensively. That is the 11th best defense in the last 60 years. And I did the last 60 years because if you look at these rankings, the Celtics in the 60s have like 5 of the 10 best marks of all time, and they did them all in a row from like 1960 to 1965. So in the last 60 years, these are the teams that have been, just to put it in context, these are the teams that have been better defensively than this year's Timberwolves. The 04 Spurs, 08 Celtics, 93 Knicks, 94 Knicks, 2020 Bucks, 04 Pistons, 14 Pacers, 16 Spurs, 05 Spurs, 99 Spurs, and then this year's Minnesota Timberwolves. One of the best defensive teams that we have seen in, call it the three-point era. Like, straight up, one of the best defensive teams we've seen. So, because of that, they have to be taken very seriously, and I don't think we can just like write them off even for the rest of the season without Towns. Like, yes, their offense is going to take a hit, but that defense is going to keep them competitive night after night. And I think it gives them a chance, not a good chance, but still a chance to hang on to that one seed, or at least stay in, you know, one of the top three seeds, hold off the Clippers. And potentially, if the Nuggets do wind up at number one, which they're looking pretty damn good right now, then if the Wolves stay in that top three, then they can still potentially avoid them until the conference finals, if they make it that far.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like I said, I just think a team that's this elite defensively, that shouldn't see any defensive drop off without Cat, and that has, you know, an offensive all around dog like Ant kind of leading things. I trust that team to hold the fort for, you know, a little less than quarter of season.
And just like a quick note about the defense, like, we don't need to say any more about Gobert and how good he's been. I think we both think he's going to win Defensive Player of the Year and will deserve it.
And by the way, that'll give him 4, which will match Ben Wallace and Dikembe Mutombo for the most ever. Obviously, the award's only been in existence for a certain period of time, so guys like Bill Russell didn't have a chance, but still, incredibly impressive.
Yeah, dude's going to the Hall of Fame, without a doubt. But I remember in like his last couple seasons, in particular in Utah, when the defensive infrastructure around him was sort of crumbling, they were having to play him almost exclusively in drop because there was no secondary rim protection. There was just no, like, a second layer of defense could not insulate him if he was playing up near the level of the ball. And I think that led people to believe that he was more of a one-dimensional defender than he actually is. And I think the way the Wolves deploy him, where obviously he's still playing in a deep drop a lot of the time, but they're using him in a variety of different coverages. And he will switch out, and he will come out and hedge. And like things like that he's able to do because you have, you know, Jaden McDaniels, Kyle Anderson, Anthony Edwards behind you, guys who can help and make plays when you get pulled away from the rim, I think has demonstrated how many different types of things that he can do defensively, on top of being still probably the best rim protector in the sport. So he's just been tremendous. That defense has been tremendous. And I'm hopeful that Towns can make it back. And, you know, their offense isn't going to be good, but he will help make it good enough that they can still be a force to be reckoned with in the playoffs. So moving on from there to the team that is a half game behind the Wolves for the top spot in the Western Conference, the very green but very dynamic Oklahoma City Thunder. Top 5 on both sides of the ball, just showing no signs of slowing down whatsoever, Cash, and giving us, honestly, very few reasons to doubt them, but for a couple of on-court things and the experience factor, which I never know how much weight to put on. And I think it's this kind of, I thought Ben Taylor made a really good point in a video that he did about the Thunder a couple weeks back, which is like, teams this young don't tend to have a ton of playoff success, but teams this young are almost never this good. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Like, there isn't a ton of precedent for this, so why are we even trying to draw on any precedent at all?
Yeah, the three youngest teams in the NBA right now are two teams in Detroit and San Antonio that have combined for 23 wins. Then there's the Thunder, who have 43 wins and are on pace for 57 wins and are led by an MVP frontrunner and are elite on both sides of the ball. It is very much unprecedented for a team this young to be this good and to look the part of contender the way the Thunder have, because they are a contender. Like, it would be foolish to look at this team, look at what they do on both sides of the ball, look at the talent they have, look at their best player, like all of it, and say, well, they're not a contender because they're too young and young teams don't win. Well, it's like, yeah, young teams also usually don't win 57 games, which they're on pace to do. Like, they're outrageously good. Now, I'll say this. I believe in the experience thing a little bit in terms of, I think history has shown us that for the most part, teams, you know, they go through like a building phase where they're building up to something. They usually have to take their lumps in the playoffs. There's usually a heartbreaking series loss. It, like, stuff happens. But I don't know how much of that is like, well, they didn't have experience, and how much of it is just teams have to go through things over the years to figure out what changes need to be made, what players need to be. Like, I think a lot of times it's chalked up to experience because people don't know what else to chalk it up to, but there's usually a much simpler basketball explanation for why a team didn't win a series, didn't win a championship, whatever, in any given year. And I think the same thing is going to happen this year with the Thunder, where if and when they're eliminated at some point this spring, because unless they win the championship, they're going to be eliminated at some point. And as great as they are and as capable as they are, I wouldn't pick them to win the championship right now. So I expect them at some point between April and June to be eliminated. And when they are, many people will probably lazily just chalk it up to inexperience. Well, they got beat by whoever. I don't know. They got upset by the Warriors. Well, those veterans just know how to win in the Thunder Dome. Or
yeah.
They got...
Okay, let me just interject quickly to say, I wouldn't pick them to win the championship either, but I think there are only two teams, and the two teams that we're going to talk about in the second half of this episode, that I would actually pick ahead of them if I were like power ranking it right now.
That's very fair. I'd probably agree with you. But my point is just that if and when they're eliminated at some point in the spring, you know there's going to be people who chalk it up to inexperience. And the fact is that if you've watched this team all year, if you dig into the numbers, if they pay attention, I think the actual thing that's probably going to sink them at some point, not because, you know, they were flawed in their construction or anything, like every team has flaws, but the one that I think will sink the Thunder isn't their age or their games played in big moments or the playoffs. It's, quite frankly, strictly size. This team has a size issue. And that's what I wrote about. I think that piece is going to go up Saturday. If you actually just look at, average height of teams and whatever, the Thunder came into this season slightly above average by average height. If you look at the 10-man rotation they've rolled out since Gordon Hayward joined the team, it literally has an average of 6'6", which is the average NBA height. So you could say, no, they're a perfectly average-sized team. They start a 7'1" center in Chet Holmgren, who, as we've talked about many times, has perfectly kind of tied this thing together on both ends. So I can see why people be like, this doesn't really add up. How are they too small or smaller than any other teams? But if you really start digging into it, one, after Chet, if you look at what their most likely playoff rotation will be, their next biggest player or next tallest player, if he's back in the rotation when he's healthy, is Jalen Williams, not J-Dub, the one they call J-Will, the bench one. And he is 6'9". And if he's not in the rotation or he's not healthy, then their second biggest player is a 6'8" oversized guard in Josh Giddey. So there aren't a lot of like big dudes in the rotation after Chet. Obviously, Chet also can't play entire games. And for as many mismatch issues as Chet presents for the opposition with his like lanky, rangy game, he is also a wiry young 7-footer that can be pushed around a little inside and physically punished. And we've seen some of the league's behemoths do that to him. So you get through all that and you start looking at it. So since we've last recorded, the Thunder had a couple games 24 hours apart where they gave up a Suns franchise record 31 rebounds to Jusuf Nurkić.
And won.
And won. They did win that game.
Important to note that as 100%, we're discussing their flaws. Yeah.
24 hours later, they lose the second half of that back-to-back against the Lakers in a game where Anthony Davis just absolutely had his way with them in ways that 24 points and 12 rebounds could never describe. Just coasted against them. And if you watched the ease with which Anthony Davis went about his business against Chet Holmgren and the Thunder that night, it starts to make sense why the Lakers are the only team this season that has beaten the Thunder three times. Of the 12 teams in playoff proper positions, top six spots right now, the Thunder are the only one that ranked bottom eight in defensive rebound rate. They're 29th. The 30th and 28th ranked teams in defensive rebound rate are 9 and 17 win teams, respectively. Only the Wizards give up more second chance points. By the way, also the last 20 years since the NBA expanded to 30 teams, the only three teams who have won a title while being even bottom 10 in defensive rebound rate, 2013 Heat, the 2017 Warriors, the 2018 Warriors, some of the most talented teams ever assembled. And that's just strictly because like it's hard to overcome getting bullied on the glass, giving up that many extra shots and opportunities, both mathematically and physically. It's hard to overcome that over an entire series and over multiple series over the course of a playoff run. So it can sink teams. As simple as it sounds, they're not big enough. They don't rebound well enough on the defensive end. It can sink them. And I think, again, one way you can dismiss this is to say, well, what does it matter? Their defense is so, like, it's still a top five defense. because they keep teams out of the paint, and Chet protects the rim to a degree where they are actually number one in defensive field goal percentage allowed at the rim. But I think there are some cracks in the foundation when you look at the defensive rebounding, when you look at the fact that by design, they do give up a lot of three-pointers. They give up the highest frequency of corner threes. It just starts to worry me when I think about a team that can get killed on the glass, that gives up a lot of threes. To me, that is a team that is ripe to be upset in the playoffs. And that, again, that's not because they're young. I would be saying this if their average age was 35 and they were the defending champs. I just think that as great as their defense is, there are some cracks there that I think can be exploited. And as we've, you know, mentioned 55 times a year, the postseason is where those flaws are exploited, and mercilessly so. I think the Thunder are at risk here. And I feel like it's gone a little under the radar, like this specific flaw of theirs, because they are this feel-good story who are top five in both ends, who are, you know, cruising to a potentially 55 to 60 win season. And they don't have that quite the microscope of a team that's maybe been around a few years, that's been knocking on the door as the traditional championship contender, that, you know, everyone's already kind of nitpicking their flaws and telling you why they can't win. The Thunder, I feel like, haven't been accepted in that tier yet, even though they're very much there. And so this one, to me, very obvious fatal flaw of theirs has kind of gone under the radar. Agree, disagree? Am I overreacting to this?
No, I don't think you're overreacting. I don't agree that it's gone under the radar. I actually think because there are actually so few holes to poke in this team, like their profile is pretty much unassailable. So I think because of that, actually, this rebounding thing has gotten a lot of attention.
All right.
I agree they don't have the same microscope on them as some other teams do, and I think that's totally fair. This is their first year of being, like, they didn't even make the playoffs last year. Yeah. So this is why I'm glad that at the start of this, you made the point of it's not necessarily just about experience for, like, the players, though I do think that means something. Like, we saw, I'm not comparing last year's Cavs, like, they weren't as talented as this year's Thunder. But we saw what happened to them in the playoffs. Like, that was a bad matchup for them, and maybe the Knicks were just a better team. But also, they played like shit, and they let themselves down. And I think you could point to that being the first go-around in the playoffs for Darius Garland and Evan Mobley. And Jared Allen had been in the playoffs before, but as he said, the lights were brighter than he expected. So that is a thing. But what you said that I think is really important is it's just as much or more about the coaching staff or the front office having to figure out what does and doesn't work or what does and doesn't translate to the playoffs. And that's where I look at this team and I'll be upfront and say, I thought they should have gone out and gotten another big guy, like somebody better than Bismack Biyombo before the deadline. I threw out Andre Drummond, for example. Like, I understand the people who are like, well, that would have completely changed their style of play and taken away from what makes them great. But to me, it's like, this could be a guy that you're playing like 18 minutes a game, you know, 12 by himself when Chet's on the bench and like 6 minutes that overlap with Chet. And I don't think that's, you know, you have Jalen Williams who's like playing, you know, maybe not quite that amount of minutes. And like, he's only played with Chet, I think 55 minutes this season, but it's not like a total reimagining of your team. And it just gives you an option, somebody you can deploy selectively. If you find yourself in a situation where another team's size and second chance generation is completely overwhelming you. That said, I understand and I'm fine with them saying, this is what's brought us success. Let's take this into the playoffs and see what happens. See how much it's going to undercut our success to have this kind of one limitation. Because look, when it comes to team construction, building an identity, building a scheme that makes sense with your personnel, it's never going to be perfect. You are always sort of focusing on one thing, leaning into one strength or multiple strengths at the cost of something else. And for the Thunder, I think that, you know, the trade-off has obviously worked very well for them in the regular season. There are some matchups that we've seen trouble them as a result of the limitations. It could bite them in the playoffs, and that will maybe change their thinking moving forward. But I'm very curious to see, you know, how it translates and how it works in the playoffs. Because in terms of the trade-offs they're making, like, yes, 29th in overall rebound rate, 29th in defensive rebound rate. That's concerning, without a doubt. But it also allows them to be this sort of fast, fluid team that flies around and leads the league in turnovers forced. You know, and it allows them, obviously, to maintain pristine spacing at the offensive end when not only can, like, anybody basically be a screener, but everybody is a threat to make plays with the ball and to shoot. And, I mean, they are statistically, like, the best shooting team in the NBA. They are shooting 50, 40, 83 as a team. And I'm rounding up that 40 from 39.5% from deep. Forgive me. But, like, that is insane. Like, they're first in the league in half-court offense on first shots. And they're second in the league in half-court defense on first shots. So I think actually overall they're third in offense and fifth in defense because of the rebounding thing, second chances, and they get no offensive rebounds and they give up a lot.
Them and the Celtics,
but
the only teams top five on both ends.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, apart from that rebounding thing and then the Josh Giddey thing, which we can talk about a little bit if you want, it's just sort of hard to poke holes in their case. Like, they are led by an MVP candidate who can get to his spots, get his shot off against any defender at any time, and I think has gotten very, very good at making plays for others when a defense is shifting all its attention his way. And then you have a dynamite secondary creator who just continues to level up in Jalen Williams. And you have this very dynamic offensive scheme where, again, anybody, any guard on the floor is a threat to screen at any time, or more likely just run up and, like, run right past the ball to create that little moment of hesitation for the defense and that little moment of space. It's just a whole lot for opposing defenses to deal with. And, I mean, can size and physicality maybe throw them out of rhythm? Absolutely, that's possible. But again, they've got no pressure on them.
Yep.
Like, we've talked about this before. I don't want teams to treat any postseason appearance when they're this good as like a throwaway. Like, it's fine, we have time. Every opportunity is precious, which is why I thought they should have done more at the deadline. But what they're doing is working. And, you know, I'm really curious and really excited to see if it can keep working. But on the Giddey front, obviously we've seen the cross-matching thing. Teams are putting their centers on him. I actually think the Thunder have started to adapt to that pretty well, like using him as a ball screener more in those situations, having him cut and do more stuff off of the ball to make teams pay for that. But that is also, I guess, a little bit of a concern where I don't know if he can be in closing lineups for them. And I thought that maybe Gordon Hayward could be the answer, but that has obviously not been the case, at least so far. He's looked pretty sluggish. He has, I think, taken 2 3-pointers in what, like, of the 7 or 8 games that he's played for them so far.
Yeah, he looks like 2024 Gordon Hayward. He ain't moving the
Yeah. So I don't know, but again, they have options. Cason Wallace, Isaiah Joe, like guys that they can plug into those closing or starting lineups if it comes to that in the playoffs, where I don't think that's necessarily going to be the thing that sinks them. And again, I think they've found some solutions to that cross-matching with Giddey's ability to be a ball screener. And if he's getting like short roll opportunities in the 4-on-3, he's a very capable playmaker who can take advantage of that too. So beyond that, what type of holes can you really poke in this team, apart from this very nebulous and hard to quantify experience factor?
Yeah, and that's exactly why I don't want to talk too much about the experience factor, because it is hard to quantify, and I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but I'm much more concerned by their inability to clean the defensive glass than I am by their ages or their postseason experience, you know? And I think that's much more worrisome for them and their playoff hopes than their age and experience are. I even with the Giddey thing, I'm pretty confident their offense is going to hold up in the playoffs. It's just the defensive side where I could see it not quite looking as good if they do run into the wrong matchup, if they do run into a big man who can absolutely feast on the offensive glass, kick it out to shooters. Like I said, they already, by design, because they do protect the paint as well as they do, they give up a lot of three-point looks. And all it takes is, you know, that kind of perfect combination of offensive rebounding and shooting off of it that can really hurt them. Like, you even think about, like I would pick the Thunder over the Kings, obviously, in a playoff series any day of the week. But then I was like, oh man, like, I feel a little scared about, like, Sabonis just absolutely feasting on the glass for a very trigger-happy team. Like, you just kind of, it lends itself to a little more variance, you know, when you give up what the Thunder give up, and that's what concerns me. Funnily enough, the team, other than the Lakers, who I mentioned, are the only ones who have beat OKC three times. It really looks like they have no answer for AD. The team that, in terms of, like, numbers and stuff, you could argue will actually be the worst matchup for them, or might be the worst matchup for them, is actually the smallest team in the league, who starts a 6'6" center in Draymond Green, and that's the Warriors, who have the third best offensive rebound rate in the league, obviously have the shooting to potentially punish OKC's scheme. And if you look at, they played four times this year. The Thunder won three of the four matchups, but only one of the four matchups did all of Shea, Holmgren, Curry, and Green all play, and that was the last matchup. The Thunder won, obviously important to note that. But in that matchup, the Warriors had 24 offensive rebounds and outscored the Thunder by 42 points from deep and lost. The Thunder won that game. Yeah. But just reasons why I think that might be a matchup you want to avoid. And the funny thing with it is, you know, if that were to happen in some scenario this spring where the Warriors, quote unquote, upset the Thunder, the very first thing people are going to talk about is, well, of course, like, these veteran Warriors who know how to win, and the young Thunder. But again, I think it's actually because matchup-wise, with the issues we've talked about with the Thunder, it's actually just a bad matchup.
I think that's a really important thing to hit on, not specifically about that matchup, but just about rebounding and how it's actually not necessarily only tied to size. Because, yeah, First of all, Chet is the second lightest player in the Thunder starting lineup. Despite being 7'1", he's lighter than Dort, than Giddey, than J-Dub, and only slightly heavier than Shea. And I think when it comes to rebounding, heft can be just as important as height. The Thunder, yes, are quote-unquote small if you look at just their heights, but, like, in terms of functional size, J-Dub, Lou Dort, like, those guys are huge. And then you have your nominal backcourt being Shea and Giddey. Again, that's major positional size. Like, they are big in a lot of ways. I think a big part of why they give up so many offensive rebounds is how they play defense, which is, like, a very scramble heavy type of D. They throw aggressive double teams, they pressure the ball, they scramble out of that, and that can leave you exposed on the defensive glass. And I'm looking at the Warriors, and, like, that surprised me, actually. I didn't realize that they were the fourth best offensive rebounding team in the league. But, like you mentioned, they're not a big team. Kevon Looney is a monster offensive rebounder, but he doesn't play that much. I think they're able to get a ton of offensive rebounds because of how much attention Steph Curry draws, because they force defenses to put two on the ball and to rotate on the backside. And that's going to open up a lot of offensive rebounding opportunities. So it's not just about size, right? It's about scheme too, and what an opposing team can force you to do, or what you decide to do as a defense. And I think that presents a really interesting, like, if that were the matchup, that would definitely be a battleground to watch. And I don't think it would be about, you know, the Warriors' size overwhelming the Thunder. It would be about, how do the Thunder want to guard Steph Curry? How bent out of shape is their defense able to get where they can scramble out of it and go back and still snare some defensive rebounds before, you know, the Warriors bury them basically under an avalanche of second chance threes? That's really interesting stuff. It's tactical to me as much as it is just a question of, like, physicality and size. So let's leave that there. We've gone way too long on these two teams, but we'll take a break. We'll come back and in 20 to 25 minutes talk about the Nuggets and Celtics.
What's up, Pound the Rock listeners? Just a friendly reminder to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can also check out the Scores Fantasy Football Podcast with Justin Boone. And in case you haven't already, download the Score app, available on iPhone and Android. That's where you can find all of our feature content, as well as live scores, updates, and breaking news. And don't forget to check out the Score's YouTube page for an informative yet lighthearted dive into the sports world's trending topics. Now back to the show.
All right, Cash, as we are wont to do, we have left ourselves not enough time to talk about what should have been the feature item on this episode, but we had a great game between the Nuggets and Celtics last night, and blessedly, we got basically two fully healthy teams that are, I don't know how likely they are to meet in the finals. You know, like if I was saying like this is the matchup versus the field, I would take the field. But if I was picking, would you go the other way?
Yeah, I think I would pick this matchup. And I know, obviously, the field, you get better odds with that. But I think I would take this matchup.
You're saying it's more likely than not that this is the finals?
Yeah.
Okay. So there you go. We got a finals preview last night. And the Nuggets come away victorious. Nikola Jokic completely unstoppable down the stretch. Let's use that as a springboard to talk about these two teams, the last two remaining in our group, the stable four, let's call them. What do you make of this game? What do you make of these teams? Obviously, we know what you make of them. They're going to the finals in your estimation. So where do you want to start?
Okay. The Celtics have been the best team start to finish. They're a juggernaut. I think this is the first time they've lost two straight since early November, and only the second time it's happened all season. That is batshit crazy to go, literally 4 months without losing back-to-back games. They've got the best top six in the league. The playoffs are a 6-8 player stage at most. Depth is of less concern there, so I'm very confident in what they do. Obviously, elite defense, championship-level shot creation. The knock continues to be how jumper reliant they are and how haywire their offense can look or can sometimes go in crunch time and the late game decision making or execution of the two J's. But then you look at it and it's like, nah, they're actually more efficient in the clutch than they are during regular play. And they're the most efficient team in the league during regular play. I think you're really reaching to poke holes in this Celtics team. And that doesn't mean they're perfect because no team is, but it's just like at some point they're cruising to mid-60s wins with what a top 10 point differential all time and, you know, checking the box when it comes to a lot of the ingredients we look for in a championship team. Like, they're as legit as it gets this season. And then the Nuggets, obviously, not just because you have to give them the respect as the defending champions, not just because, as I've mentioned countless times, like Jokic and Murray together almost, like, basically don't lose in the playoffs, but they're still just a really great two-way team. And Jokic, and I know like you tweeted about this yesterday, it's almost not even worth getting into or like nitpicking how a team schemes against Jokic's Nuggets because Jokic is an unsolvable riddle. Like there are no great counters for this guy. He's an absolute basketball wizard and savant. And like Porzingis last night, not strong enough. Okay, could have predicted that. Has the length and the height, obviously, but then Jokic is just like effortlessly flipping those awkward kind of shots somehow over Porzingis' arms. And then, you know, like I saw some people tweeting about how the heft of Horford and even Xavier Tillman was like a little better on Jokic. Like, all right, sure, but come on. You know, like they're not slowing him in a potential finals matchup. And then, you know, they do the thing they've done all year. I think you wrote about earlier this year too, where they put Drew on the center, right? And Drew does his darndest against Jokic. I think they even had Jaylen Brown on him in mismatches for some times. And they would go small and bring the help. And Jokic feasted on that for the most part too. It's like, I don't think there's anything here to fault the Celtics. It's almost impossible to stop this dude. And
no, there's nothing to fault. They tried everything.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. They tried so many different things. Some of them worked for like 30 seconds. Most of them worked for no time at all. And in the end, the Nuggets won a great game between two great teams. I mean, I'll ask you, like, did you see anything in this game, I don't know, scheme-wise, matchup-wise, that you thought was really interesting for if they meet 3 months from now? Did it kind of go the way you thought it would in terms of the way each team matched up?
I guess it jumped out to me that, and I know Tatum just had a really lousy game, and that was a big part of this, but the Nuggets, I thought, really defended the Celtics well. And I just think that's something in general that probably hasn't gotten enough attention this year, how good Denver's been defensively. They've been top 10 in defensive efficiency basically the whole year. They're ninth right now, and that's picking up from where they left off at the end of last year when they, as we've talked about numerous times, were for like 3 months of the year a top five defense, and then were the number four defense in the playoffs last year. This is a really good defensive team. And I think with Jokic, like you said, offensively, it's a completely unsolvable puzzle. And we've known this, but it does feel maybe a bit more acute to me than ever because, A, I don't think his conditioning has ever been better than it is right now. Like, he just does not slow down at all as the game wears on. And I don't think his defense has ever been this good before. And that those two things are probably correlated, right? Like, the idea of, well, we can't do anything with him at the offensive end, but let's make him work on defense. I still think that is what you have to try and do, but it doesn't really seem to tire him out. And he's able to do the thing where he's getting up to the level of the screen, and then he's getting back, and he's banging in the post, and now he's, you know, you're seeing him used in drop more often, which again is carryover from something we saw toward the end of last year with their defense. And he's insulated, man, with KCP at the point of attack, who's been unbelievable. Aaron Gordon, who has been like all defense caliber to me as a low helper and as a guy who's taking on the big wing assignments. Jamal Murray, again, underrated defender. When he dials it in, I thought he was fantastic defensively last night. Had some really good possessions on Tatum. So, I would point to that as like this Nuggets offense, we know what it can do. Defensively, they held the best offense, at least statistically the best offense in the league, in check, and that was super impressive. I think, you know, we can talk about, I guess, the crunch time stuff, because I think we've said this on a previous episode. Like, there's a spotlight or a magnifying glass on the Celtics crunch time woes because, I mean, I guess there are a few reasons, but really it stands out because that's the only way that they ever lose, right? Like, they've lost 14 games this entire year, and 10 of them have involved clutch time, which, as we know, means the game is within 5 points in the last 5 minutes. But in terms of their crunch time process, yeah, like, it slows down. Like, their pace drops off. The ball movement drops off a bit. It's a little bit too much hero ball. But as I've said before, basically every team and every star player plays this way in crunch time, except for Jokic and the Nuggets.
Yeah.
And I think you could say the Warriors, to a certain extent, still run their motion stuff in crunch time, but it's not really the same thing because they still do wind up having to settle for, you know, tough shots at isolation when defenses can sort of neutralize their initial actions. But like, Jokic is just creating high value shots for himself and his teammates every trip down the floor, even in crunch time. And that is the exception. And I don't think it's fair to hold the Celtics to that standard. So watching that, it just made me think, like, you know, there's the prevailing wisdom about performance in the clutch, you know, how successful a team is in close games. The prevailing wisdom is that, like, a lot of that is luck. And I think there are certain teams that supersede that logic, and the Nuggets are one of them. Like, their point differential is not reflective of the quality of their team because they will do stuff like mess around with five-man bench groups, which I know they haven't been doing lately, but they play a lot of bench-heavy lineups that don't work. Earlier in games, they can be kind of laissez-faire for stretches where, like, they're not valuing possessions enough. But I think in crunch time, that's where we see how they separate themselves from the rest of the league, just with the level of execution and attention to detail and decision-making and shot-making, along with that very strong and very underrated defense. That is where we see them set themselves apart. So I do think, like, yeah, when you watch these two different teams in crunch time, you see one team is able to create better shots than the other. And that is just because they have the best player in the world who, you know, is just completely unbothered by whatever you throw at him. And I don't think the Celtics should be, you know, raked over the coals for not doing enough. Like you said, they tried everything. They went double big. They tried Horford on him with Porzingis roaming. They tried Drew on him for a stretch with Porzingis roaming. They tried Porzingis on him in single coverage. They tried bringing help. Nothing worked. Do I think they could maybe have more success by like closing with two bigs? I kind of do. But I can't say with any degree of certainty that that would have made a lick of difference. But if I could point to anything and be like, that might have been worth trying, I might have said maybe close with Horford. But then who are you taking off the floor?
Exactly.
You know, like you want to take Drew off the floor? He was like the only guy who was making buckets in crunch time for them.
Yeah.
Because the Nuggets had Jokic guarding him at the other end. And he made a couple of big threes for them to get them back in the game. So like...
Yeah, crazy as it might sound, Drew Holiday's shooting really big for this league-leading offense.
Yeah. So that's kind of like what I took away, I guess, from that game specifically. And I just think, you know, again, to take it back to the Celtics, there are, I think, some holes that you can poke, but like, they're fine. You know, like what did Jaw say? Like I'm fine in the West, or I'm good in the West. Like they're good in the East.
Yeah.
The Celtics are good in the East, or they should be. If they find a way to lose before the finals again, we might have to have a referendum. But you know, they're
well, what'd you say about Eric Spoelstra last night?
He'll have to answer for his crimes, man, if he finds a way to prevent this finals from happening. Because these are the two best teams in the league, and I want to see them play in the finals. But I'm sure that Spo has something up his sleeve, some way that he's gonna fuck it up. But I think, look, the Celtics calling card is going to be their defense, right? Even though their offense is currently the most efficient in NBA history. And yes, every year, the most efficient offense from here on out basically will be the most efficient in history. But, and this will have come down from last night's game, but going into that game, relative offensive rating, they were 16th in the history of basketball. Very good offensive team, and yet I have way more faith in their defense than in their offense. I just, like, I think back to the conversation we had about teams making those tough choices, whether to soft switch, whether to switch and double, whether to put two on the ball to stay out of the switch when they're protecting their weak defenders. The Celtics do not have to deal with any of those kind of tough coverage questions. And of course, it's different when you're going up against a player like Nikola Jokic, and you got to try a bunch of different things, and that's going to force you into some tough decisions. But against every other team, they just do exactly what they want to do defensively. Nobody forces them really into a bind that makes them veer from what they... Like, they are dictating the terms. They can switch themselves into pretty much any matchup and feel comfortable with that and not have to send emergency help. They put two on the ball probably less than any team in the league. They stay out of rotation better than any team in the league. They don't give up shots at the rim. They don't give up corner threes. They clean the defensive glass. They're dead last in turnovers forced. But then, like, we talk about trade-offs, right? That is the worthwhile trade-off for what they are able to do so well on defense. And, like, that is going to be, if they're going to beat the Nuggets in a series, that's what's going to do it for them, I think, is their defense. And Jokic is a guy who can pick any defensive coverage apart. But if they can limit everybody else, they have a chance. Do you want to talk about Aaron Gordon for just a couple of minutes?
Be my guest. You want just about what? Like, you think he's underappreciated? You think?
I don't know if he's under. I think people appreciate him. He's like one of the most unique players in basketball. I don't think there's anybody who really plays the way that he does and has his combination of strength, athleticism, and ball skill. And I remember there was a game that Jokic missed a few weeks back. I think it might have been against the Thunder, where Gordon started at center and played like 41 minutes as a full-time five. And the Thunder are a team that you can get away with doing that against, maybe more than others, but like...
As we discussed.
But he finished that game with like 15 rebounds and 7 assists because he was operating as like a hub in kind of the same way that Jokic does. He can do that because he can really pass the ball and he can handle it. He has some guard skill. And then, you know, he can shift into this other role where he's like screening and diving or cutting or playing in the dunker spot, just like a ridiculous above the rim finisher. Like, he can slide into and out of these different roles in a very fluid way. And I like the different ways that they can use him, the different like defensive and offensive roles that he can occupy, make him kind of a skeleton key, I think, for this Nuggets team. And I always think back to when they got him and how excited we were about it. And even as excited as we were, and us saying at the time, like, this could be the final piece of a championship puzzle, even as excited as we were about it at the time, I don't think I could have foreseen him fitting quite as well as he has. And I thought he was a huge factor in that game last night on both sides of the ball. And that, like, windmill putback dunk that he had, and then obviously, like, the crunch time dagger when he, again, maybe the best dunker spot player in basketball, period. And that is benefited hugely by Jokic's ability to use the dunker spot as a passer. But, like, Jokic posting up Porzingis, drawing a little bit of help, going to what looks like a hook shot, and it's just an alley-oop pass to Gordon for the exclamation mark. Chef's kiss, man.
Yeah, I had tweeted about that too, because, like, I thought it was going to be a shot just because Jokic is that brilliant that I was convinced that was going in anyway, even though it looked as awkward as it did. And then it ended up somehow being even more impressive as a pass. Just classic Joker. With respect to Gordon, yeah, man, he's just, look, great size, explosive, physical, a lot of offensive utility in different roles, good playmaker for his size. Obviously, as you mentioned, maybe the best dunker spot player in the game. Solid screener. Defensively, one of the best secondary help guys. But also, obviously, big enough, strong enough, defensively solid enough to guard the opposing team's best players. Like, he really kind of does it all. And I think it's a good reminder, too, when you look at Aaron Gordon's career progression and the role he's found, the integral role he's found on a championship team, it's an important reminder that, like, just because a guy maybe isn't capable of being, like, the franchise guy wherever he's drafted, even as a high draft pick, or isn't the star or all-star some people hoped he might be early in his career, doesn't mean he's not a great player and can't be an incredible role player for a great team. That doesn't have to be like a knock on him. It's like, oh, this guy's just a role player. No, it's like Aaron Gordon's a phenomenal basketball, not just like he's a phenomenal NBA player, even for NBA standards. And he's a guy that probably ends up, you know, never being an all-star, but he's just so good. And there are maybe people from earlier in his career where if you had told them, I don't know, midway through his second season that this is who he's going to be, might be like, well, that's a bit disappointing. I thought he'd be an all-star, like a franchise player in Orlando. And it's like, no, it's just this is like a really great outcome for an NBA player, no matter where he's drafted. And I think it's just a good reminder of that.
Yeah. And I think it's actually rare because you can see a lot of these guys where you're like, you see how it could work if he was in the right situation.
Yeah.
And you can dream on that and be like, you know, I know because he's overextended or he isn't in the right role or the right, you know, the roster context around him isn't correct, that it's not working. But you can see how good, how effective that player could be in the right situation. And I think it's rare that we actually get to see that completely optimized in this way. And with Gordon, it was like, for how long did we talk about this is not the role he should be playing? He's overextended in Orlando. Like, let's get him in a situation where he can be doing pretty much exactly what he's doing now, but he couldn't have landed in a better situation than this. Like, it's just beyond perfect.
Yeah, I think one, it's rare that a player ends up in that right situation when they have this skill set. But two, I think to Gordon's credit too, I think, you know, probably self-awareness is a big part of it too. And not every player has that requisite self-awareness where even maybe if they did land in the right role, maybe they wouldn't see themselves as that kind of perfect fitting role player and would still want to be something that they're just not cut out to be.
Okay, one last question for you about the Celtics. So the numbers say this is an all-time great team, at least in the regular season. Plus 11.1 net rating is, I had it when it was plus 11.4 and that was like fourth all-time. I don't know if that's dipped them down at all. Let me check actually really quickly. That puts them sixth all time. So that's what the numbers say they are, is like an all time juggernaut. Does it feel that way to you? You know, like watching them or just thinking about them, do they have in your mind the gravitas of the type of teams that have had like similarly overwhelming statistical profiles in the past? And if not, why not?
So the first answer is no. But I think that's one, it's about star quality and the star factor. And two, I think it's also just about like maybe the way nostalgia feels versus being in the present day, where it's like, it doesn't feel like the Celtics are the all-time team of some of, like, well, obviously, like, the Bulls teams of when I was a kid, or then the Shaq and Kobe Lakers at their absolute zenith, or the Big Three Heat, or the KD Warriors. And it's like, I can be like, well, no, they're not as good as those teams. But then, you know, the numbers back up that they're actually, in terms of relative to their peers at the time they're playing, they're dominating the league like those teams did. And so, you know, you have to consider, like, okay, am I coming at this from an objective point of view, or am I being clouded a little bit by nostalgia and all that? But the star quality part, I think, is real. Like, there's no way around the fact that for as great as the Celtics are, for as great as their top six is, they're not as talented as a lot of the teams that we're talking about that have dominated the league the way the Celtics are this year, right? Whether it is those Jordan Bulls, whether it is the Shaq and Kobe, like, the two J's are great and that top six is great, but it's not the Kevin Durant Warriors. It's not LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh. It's not Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman. It's not Shaq, Kobe. Like, you know what I mean? And so I think that plays a big part into it, where I can look at them this year, look at the record, look at the numbers and say, yeah, they're dominating, but are they as dominant as those teams in my eye? Like, do I view them the same? No. Do you?
I don't, but I'm just wondering how much of that is my lizard brain unable to conceive of the future as anything but an extension of the present.
Right.
And, like, the way that I finished that piece that I wrote about them this week is, like, there isn't the precedent in place. They haven't won before. And we've seen them have these letdowns in the playoffs where they've lost to teams that on paper look worse. There is the Tatum thing where he's not a top five player in the league, and that maybe makes it harder to conceive of them as, like, an all-time team. There are all these factors, right? And some of them are legit. But to your point about nostalgia, romanticizing the past, it's like, okay, well, if they go on to win the title, then we're going to remember all these things a lot differently. You know, we're not going to say, like, that they were an imperfect team who didn't have, like, an A-tier superstar, and, like, their bench was maybe, like, a bit tenuous, and all the stuff that we could poke holes in now, we'll just be like, holy shit, that was one of the best teams we've seen. So, no, it doesn't feel that way to me now, but I just wonder how much of that is, like, the fact that we haven't seen them win the whole shebang yet. And what I said at the end of that piece is, like, if they do romp through the East, which the numbers suggest they should, and then defeat, you know, whether it's the Nuggets or another one of these top teams in the West, and win the title, I feel like it could be one of those things where we look back and it feels inevitable in hindsight. Or, like, yeah, obviously they won. Obviously we should have seen this coming. They kicked the shit out of everybody in the regular season, with the exception of Denver. But they were just miles better than everybody during the regular season. And, you know, then in our memory, they will grow in stature and become one of these all-time teams. But right now, no, it doesn't feel that way. Because Tatum as their best player is not on the level of, it's like really just like, you know, five or six guys in the league. It's no slight.
Yeah.
But we've seen them have these kind of hiccups in crunch time. We've seen Jaylen Brown have some issues against elite defenses with his playmaking and his handle. I do think, you know, there's something as good as, like, Pritchard and Horford and Hauser have been off the bench. It's basically a three-man bench, and, like, there are some question marks with all those guys. There are reasons why, like, legit reasons why I think you can feel a little bit less sure of them than their statistical profile suggests you should be.
Yes, agreed. But, you know, if they romp through the playoffs the way the numbers suggest they might, there's gonna be an eight-year-old basketball-loving kid out there who years from now is going to look at this Celtics team as that team, like, and they're going to remember, oh, when I was a kid, like, they won 65 games and outscored teams by friggin' 11 points per game. They had Tatum and Brown and Porzingis and White and Horford and Hall. Like, you know what I mean? So, yeah, like, if they get the job done in the playoffs after the season they've had, for a lot of people, they are going to look back years from now and be like, well, that team was actually one of the best we ever saw just based on their performance.
And look, Tatum's obviously going to get crushed for the game that he had last night, and especially for missing that wide open corner three that would have given the Celtics the lead in the final minute. I do think the fact that they had a chance to take the lead in the final minute of that game, I We're not doing moral victories. I'm just saying they were trailing pretty much from the second quarter onward. Tatum had the stinker that he had. And I, you know, this wasn't like an A-plus game from the Nuggets, but the Nuggets played very well, I thought. And the Celtics were right there with a chance to take the lead in the final minute. I think that's pretty encouraging, all things considered.
Yeah.
And again, we shouldn't be doing moral victories for a team that we're talking about as one of the best regular season teams of all time. But I think that like that was like a C-plus game from the Celtics maybe, and they were right there at the end. So like the fact that the Nuggets have like very narrowly won their two regular season head-to-heads doesn't mean that they're like far and away a better team. And like I would consider them a favorite in a final series between them, but like I think the margins are very slim.
Agreed. Okay, I know we're at 80 minutes, so I don't even want to discuss this. I just want to, I think a funny way to bookend this episode based on the way I started it would be just providing a random fun fact that has nothing to do with either of the four teams that we've talked about today, because it's one I actually forgot to put out last week. So if you will, I just want to throw this fun fact out there, fun stat out there. And again, you literally don't have to respond to it at all. You can go right into our outro if you want, but I just wanted to point out, Draymond Green is shooting 43.5% from deep this year. That's a career sub 32% shooter doing that. A guy whose previous career high was 38.8 years ago is up to 43.5% on the season. Obviously not a giant sample or crazy volume, but to give you an idea of the kind of shooting season he's having, you know, compared to the rest of his career, he has now matched his total three-pointers made from last season on 39 less attempts.
Yeah.
And that's it. Unrelated to that.
That 39% three-point shooting season that you're referencing, which was their 73-win campaign in 2015-16, he hit 100 threes.
Yeah.
He's hit 40 this year. So, yeah, the volume is...
last year, but yeah, on 39 less attempts so far this year.
No, but so... And, like, nobody guards him, and nobody's going to guard him.
Yeah.
So that's not changing defensive behavior, but the fact that he's able, like, been able to knock down about one of those per game when he gets left wide open like that is actually pretty significant. I feel like there are a few of these guys who have actually just been like randomly having really good shooting seasons despite being treated as complete non-shooters. I don't think Herb Jones is in that category anymore. I think he shot it well enough that he is starting to garner defensive respect, but he's at like 43% from deep. Isaac Okoro's at 40% from deep. You mentioned the Draymond one. There are some others that I'm probably forgetting right now, but this stuff is all very interesting as we look toward the playoffs, okay? Yeah. Because we know that these guys are going to get completely ignored, and how many of those wide open threes they can actually make is going to make or break a team's playoff series, potentially playoff run. You know, like if Herb Jones shoots 43-44% in a playoff series, like, that meaningfully changes their odds of winning that series versus if he falls off and goes back to shooting like 30%. So, something to watch. Should we get out of here?
Let's get out of here.
Cash, before we get out of here, fan shout out for us.
Yeah, I've got a funny one this week. And, you know, those who've listened for a long time know that at the end of the show when we do the call out so that fans can reach out and then we can shout them out, we do the whole spiel about how to reach us on social media. You know, oh, let us know where you listen from, how long you've been listening, what you like about the show, maybe what you don't like. But realistically, it's like, all right, obviously, we just want you to tell us what you like, because if you tell us what you don't like, but once in a while, people will actually send us a note to tell us what they don't like. You know, Frank Costanza style. I got a lot of problems with you people now. I'm going to tell you about him. Well, Marcus in Australia took to the reviews, gave us the worst review I can find for us, which is only a 3-star review. We've got a 4.7 average. I think it was 4.8 before Marcus from Australia's ass got in here. But here's why I find this so hilarious. So Marcus, who I'm assuming doesn't even listen anymore, but he must have listened for like a few episodes here and there over the last couple seasons when Joel Embiid and the Sixers were the topic du jour, because his complaint is that this is a Philly fan cast and they should call this Pound Embiid's podcast, because it's pretty clear one or both are Philly fans and talk about Philly or Embiid at every opportunity while 80% of the rest of the league gets ignored. And I'm sorry, it's just, I laughed out loud, cackled, reading this feedback and review because I think there are a lot of Sixers fans who listen to this podcast who will probably say, if anything, you know, me especially maybe has been unfairly critical of Embiid in the past. I happily go on 17-minute rants every April or May when Embiid flops in the playoffs. Like, we've been so critical of Embiid and the Sixers over the years. I don't think we've over-talked about the Sixers in ways that they're not just part of the NBA discourse because they've been one of the consistently good teams over the last few years. They've got the reigning MVP and a guy who might have won a second straight this year who was having the greatest scoring season ever before he got hurt. Like, I think we just talked about them an adequate amount, but I just find it hilarious that this random listener in Australia must have tuned in only when we talk Sixers and came away from this thinking we're two guys in Philadelphia, you know, running a Philly fan cast.
Yeah, I think that was probably directed mostly at me, that comment, which, yeah, I'm sorry that I like to talk about the reigning MVP who was having one of the best offensive seasons we've ever seen before he got injured this year in a very controversial decision by his organization to play him amid a media hailstorm about his apparent desire to duck the guy who won the two MVPs before him. Sorry that I like to talk about him. Anyway, all right. In the future, when you reach out for a call out, just tell us what you like about the show. We're going to drop that. We're going to drop the tell us what you don't from the spiel that we do at the end of these episodes. Just
and perfect segue for me to remind our listeners to please reach out on Twitter. Find me at Joseph Cacciaro. Find Wolfon at Joey_YOU. Email joseph.cacciaro@thescore.com, joe.wolfon@thescore.com, or find me on Instagram at joe__cash. And let us know where you listen from, how long you've been listening, what you like about the show, what you don't like while you sit there in Australia. Let us know. We want to give you a fan shout out, good, bad, or otherwise.
Let's go Sixers. For Joseph Cacciaro, I'm Joe Wolfine. Pound the rock.